This year's January Bible study is Revelation chapters 2 and 3, the seven churches of Revelation. And it challenges us to think about what does the Spirit of the Lord want to say to the church? Now you could say, what does the Spirit of the Lord want to say to the church? Universal. Or you can narrow that to the church in North America. Or what does the Spirit of the Lord want to say to the church in Oklahoma? But we want to focus our attention on what the Spirit of the Lord wants to say to this church, Quell Springs Baptist Church, at this particular time in its history. And if you want to say, well, what would the Spirit of the Lord say to the church, to this church in particular, I'd say, well, that depends on what our strengths and weaknesses are. Because that's what happens in these seven churches. He addresses both what's good in the churches and what's not good in the churches, and then proposes a way forward for them. And just generally, when you think about the church in America in the 21st century, there are several problems that we have to deal with. One of them is a complacency. And the complacency is rooted in our prosperity, in our affluence and our influence. And we take this as a good thing. We take it as a blessing that so many individuals in the church in America are people who have means, who have financial security. That flows over into the churches in which those people are members, and that's a good thing. We count that as a blessing. But there can also be a complacency that comes along with that. When you can see your way forward, when you can take care of all of your needs without divine intervention in some way, it's easy to become complacent and think, well, we can do this. We've got this. We fight that in the church in the U.S., For other churches, it's the struggle to maintain separation from the culture around us. That we don't look like and act like other organizations in the community. I mean, what is it that makes the church distinct from other organizations like the Salvation Army or other groups in the community that might be doing very good things? What is it that makes us different? Some churches struggle with a stagnation that manifests itself in a lack of concern about sharing the good news with others. And here's how it sort of plays out in a typical church in the U.S. We become satisfied with growth through people moving their membership here and satisfied through the growth that comes by baptizing the children of those people who are already members here without much concern for growth in any other avenue. It's a stagnation that comes from a lack of concern to share the good news with people who are not part of the church, who we might look at and think, well, they're probably not interested, or we don't know what their spiritual condition might be. It's the willingness to share the gospel with those people that the church ought to be about, and there is a stagnation that occurs when churches lose the motivation to do that. Though the issues for the churches in the book of Revelation, these seven churches, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Laodicea, and Philadelphia, though their struggles in the first century in Asia Minor would not be precisely the same struggles the church in the U.S. or this particular church might have today, there are ways in which our struggle is the same. We are alike in that we face the struggle to maintain our commitments to Christ. We are alike in that we struggle to be His authentic people in the world. We are alike in that we struggle to live the way of the Lamb until He comes. And so the book of Revelation addresses these seven churches. It's sort of typical to begin in chapter 2 with the church at Ephesus, but I think you really need to begin in chapter 1. And you need to begin with the revelation, the image of this vision of Christ that John receives. Who is the sender of these seven letters to these seven churches? We could say it's John, but really it's not John. John is merely writing down what he hears and what he sees. So who is the sender? I think John reveals that to us in Revelation chapter 1, beginning at verse 9. He says, I, John, your brother and companion. So he begins by sort of creating this fellowship with the audience, with the churches that he's going to write these letters to. He calls himself a brother, reminding us that the church is a family. We are brothers and sisters. God is our Father. We have been adopted into God's family. We are brothers and sisters. It's totally appropriate to refer to himself in that way. And then companion or sharer. In what? In the suffering. Now, John knows this very literally. At the time when John writes the book of Revelation, he has been exiled about 40 miles off the coast from Ephesus, which was sort of the primary city in Asia Minor. That's where he had been, a leader in the church, late in his life. But he'd been exiled by the Romans to the island of Patmos, about 40 miles away from Ephesus. Just about 10 miles long and 6 miles wide island out in the Aegean Sea. It was a place that the Romans sent often political people, people that they concerned them. I'm quite certain that John's prophesying and John's ministry, the Romans would see this as some sort of the threat to their social order. His work in the churches and the growth of Christianity, which was not a legal religion in the Roman Empire, would be seen as subversive. And so a person like John, a leader in the church, the last remaining disciple who was actually with Jesus, I can understand why the Romans might want to exile him and get him a bit out of the picture. So Patmos was a place of hard labor. There's an early church father that suggests that maybe John was boiled in hot water, not killed in that way, but that he just was tortured in that way. So when he says that he is a sharer in the suffering, he knows suffering. And these churches likely know some suffering because of their identification with Jesus. So he says he's a brother, he's a sufferer in the suffering and in the kingdom. He and these believers in these seven churches are part of a kingdom in which they are citizens, the kingdom of God. This kingdom had come in its fullness in the coming of Jesus, and now they are citizens in that kingdom. The book of Revelation also reminds us there's another kingdom that exists. It's a kingdom of darkness and destruction of God's purposes in the world. It's led by Satan and the dragon and Babylon, all part of this rival kingdom, of which ultimately the Lamb will defeat. So he speaks of himself as a sharer, a companion in the suffering, in the kingdom, and in the patient endurance that is ours in Jesus. This is the way he begins to introduce himself to these seven churches. And then verse 10, on the Lord's day, I was in the Spirit, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet. And often you get this image of a trumpet blast that signals somehow the coming of Jesus. And here it is, his voice is like a trumpet, which said, write on a scroll what you see and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Now there's the commission that he receives from this voice that sounds like a trumpet. So he hears something, and then he sees something. And that begins in verse 12. I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me, and when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. Now, there's much in the book of Revelation that's difficult to interpret, or we can't be sure about what the symbol might point to, but this is one of the easier ones. Because when you look down in verse 20 of chapter 1, he speaks of the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven golden lampstands, and it is this. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. So we don't need to run off trying to figure out, oh my goodness, what are the seven lampstands? They're the seven churches that he's about to address. He gives us that one. It's good. We've got that one. So he sees the seven lampstands, which represent the seven churches. And among the lampstands was someone like a son of man. Now, when you hear that phrase, son of man, you likely think of a human being. I mean, we're all here sons or daughters of a man, of a father. In that sense, we're all alike, and it speaks of our humanity. That's typically not what the emphasis is in the New Testament, particularly when Jesus refers to himself as a son of man. And here, when John sees the revelation, he uses the phrase son of man. It almost always refers not to Jesus' humanity, which is true, but to his majestic power as one who is coming in the clouds in glory. And an important text is in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. Here is the Son of Man, and I think it's the Son of Man that John has in mind, and Jesus has in mind when he refers him to himself as the Son of Man. Listen to what Daniel sees in Daniel 7, 13 and 14. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. We'd think of that as maybe the Father. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So when John turns around and sees this one like the Son of Man, I don't think he thinks of just a human being. He's talking about this Son of Man from the book of Daniel, who is one filled with power and glory coming on the clouds. Now look at how else he describes him. He is dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet with a golden sash around his chest. What would the image of a long robe and a golden sash indicate? It's royalty. There's something majestic, there's something royal. This is Christ the King that he sees in this image. How about his hair? So we see his robe. Verse 14, the hair on his head was like wool, as white as snow. I can relate to that image. But I don't think that this is some way indicating that Jesus was prematurely graying because of worry for the churches. I would say quite the opposite, that this hair, this white hair, represents wisdom and dignity and purity. Now this might be one way, as I said, I can relate. But when you see this white hair on the Son of Man, it's wisdom and dignity and purity. What else does he see? Still in verse 14, his eyes were like blazing fire. Now that's an image of piercing. I've heard someone say his eyes were piercing. They just felt like they could see right through you. Well, that's precisely the image here. It's of discriminating insight. That these flaming eyes have the power to burn away all pretense and hypocrisy and to see our inmost thoughts and our inmost desires. Nothing escapes these eyes like flaming torches. What else does he see? His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace. That's the image of stability, of strength. I mean, if you've got bronze feet, you're not going to easily be moved or knocked over. So he has feet like bronze. His voice was like the sound of rushing waters. I don't know if you've ever been to like Niagara Falls or just your local falls is good. And you hear the power, the force of the waters. It's powerful. It's majestic. Now, I don't know about waterfalls in Patmos. I don't know of any. But I know the waters beating against the shore of Patmos would qualify as rushing mighty waters. That might be what John is thinking about when he speaks of the voice of the Son of Man like rushing mighty waters. The sounds of rushing waters. Verse 16, in his right hand he held seven stars. Well, what are the seven stars? Well, we get a little help there. Look down in verse 20 again. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. Now, this could be one of at least two things. One, it could literally be angels. It could be like a guardian angel over each of the churches. And the fact that God holds these seven stars or these seven angels in his right hand shows his protection and authority over them as they act to protect the churches. So it could literally be angels. But the word for angel in the New Testament can also just be translated messenger. So it could be the pastors or the pastoral leadership of the seven churches. In either case, they are held in the Son of Man's right hand, showing his protection of them and his authority over them as they protect and have authority over the churches. And coming out of his mouth was a sharp, double-edged sword. I think that double-edged sword points to both the ability in God's hand to protect his people, but also the other edge of that sword is his ability to judge his people. The one who holds the sword, particularly in the ancient world, that showed the power of life and death, the power to protect or to judge, even the power of capital punishment. You often see these images of Caesar with the sword in his hand. That's the image of the Son of Man with the power to protect or to judge. And his face was like the sun shining in all its brilliance. The dazzling splendor of the glory of God with this image of his face like the sun shining in all its brilliance. All of these words, letters that he will write to the churches have to be seen through the lens of this vision of Christ, the Son of Man, who is King, majestic in all of his glory and brilliance. He's the one responsible for the letters that go to the churches. John is writing what this one gives him to write. He's the sender of the letters. Now, I don't know what you have in your mind right now as we went through this image. If you have sort of a flat-footed, literal picture of Jesus right now, that's a pretty odd image. You just put these images together. I mean, literal eyes that are flaming fire. Feet like bronze. I'm not sure that's the way we should read Revelation generally. You need a little imagination. You got to see, what does this image point to? I think a way of thinking about this is like someone who's totally captivated with the person he loves. I'll go from the image of a man talking about the woman that he loves. I mean, think about if you said, I'm so in love with my wife, let me explain her to you. Let me describe her to you. She has a neck like a swan. Now, you know exactly what that means, that she's graceful. There's a gracefulness to her. But if you take that literally, I don't think that's a compliment. You could just as easily say, did you see that woman? She had a neck like a swan. It was skinny and long. You sort of lose something in the just flat-footed literalism of it. Or how about, she has eyes like pools. Okay, that could be like, you know, glassy or sparkling. But you kind of need to know what kind of pool. There are like cesspools and other kinds of pools. What would eyes like swimming pools? Would that really be attractive? How about, you know, cheeks like rose petals? I mean, I think we know what that means, that, you know, there's maybe soft and fragrant or something like that. But actual cheeks that look like rose petals might not be that attractive. I think we know what to do with that. Well, I think that's what we should do with this image that John sees. He's trying his best to pull together images that describe the power and the majesty, and it's hard to capture it. He could just say he had great power and he was kingly, but to describe it in such a way, and if we'll use our imagination a bit, we might be struck by the same power and majesty that John was. Who are these letters from? They're from this one who is like the Son of Man. He says in verse 19, write therefore what you have seen, what is now and what will take place later, the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven golden lampstands is this. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. And the image of this one like a Son of Man who's moving and walking in the midst of the seven lampstands is a description of a God who is not an absentee landlord. No matter what might be going on in these churches, no matter what persecution they might be facing, no matter what struggles they might be having, the Son of Man is in this thing with them. And John sees the Son of Man moving among the seven lampstands. That is, among the seven churches. Now, who's the recipient? Chapter 2, verse 1, the first letter. To the angel of the church in Ephesus write, and there it is. The first letter goes to the church at Ephesus. It seems absolutely appropriate that it would. Ephesus was the third or fourth largest city in the Roman Empire at the time. Rome would have been larger, Alexandria would have been larger, and then maybe Antioch in Syria. So it's third or fourth. Most estimates are 250,000 population in the first century at the time when John would have been writing. They had a theater there that would seat 25,000. I've been in that theater. I've stood where the speaker would stand on what would have been the stage in that theater and spoke at pretty much conversational tone. And my colleague from OBU, Dr. Bandy, who's taught here some, was with me. He went up and sat as far up as they'd let you go in the theater that's been excavated there. And I spoke in a conversational tone, and he could hear me without any, you know, device or megaphone. It was just the acoustics of the place, you know, 2,000 years later, still impressive. It would have struck you also the idolatry of the city of Ephesus. I've seen just in what's been excavated there, and it's just a small percentage of the city, but I've seen the idols, the monuments to idols. And the thing that is most impressive there is no longer there, but history tells us about the Temple of Artemis, or in the Roman system, Diana. You can still see one of the columns there But it was massive, like four times the size of the Parthenon in Greece. One of the seven wonders of the world, of the ancient world. This was the goddess, the deity of the city. And Artemis is a deity of fertility. And there would have been thousands of priests and priestesses who served that temple in Ephesus. And there would have been idolatry there. There would have been sexual immorality that was tied to the worship of the goddess. These priestesses there would be temple prostitutes. And this was the dominant image of idolatry in the city of Ephesus at the time when Paul helps establish the church there. There was also the worship of the Roman emperor, or the dead Roman emperors, the emperor cult. And there would be pressure on you, if you were part of the Roman Empire, to worship the emperor. And there were temples there in Ephesus by which you could burn incense and do just that. So think about how difficult it would be for a Christian living in a city like that, where there would be pressure both from the pagans and from the Romans to worship, whether Artemis or whether the emperor. And this is the letter to the first church, is to the church there at Ephesus. These are the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks among the seven golden lampstands. Now here's the message. In verses 2 through 6. First, he commends them. I know your works, your hard labor, and your endurance or your perseverance. I know that you cannot tolerate the wicked people, that you have tested those who claim to be apostles but are not, and have found them false. You have persevered and have endured hardships for my name and have not grown weary. And then go down to verse 6. But you have this in your favor. You hate the practices of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. So he begins with what's good in the church. He commends them for certain things. He commends them for their deeds or their works. It's just a basic word in Greek that has to do with deeds done, works. My guess is he's talking more generally here about their spiritual walk. But he likes the works or the deeds he sees, he knows about the church at Ephesus. The second thing he says is your labor, your hard work. Now, it's a different word in Greek. Two words here for work. One more generally work, the other more arduous, difficult, labor. We use that word in English, labor. And we can talk about labor unions or something like that that has to do with work. But I think maybe the best image I can think of in English to capture this word in Greek is what a woman does at the end of a little 9-month gestation process. She goes into labor. And anybody who's ever witnessed this experience knows this is difficult, arduous, painful toil. This is not just, you know, clocking in, getting the job done, and clocking out. This is a different kind of labor. I think that describes well the word he has here. It's not that you're just doing deeds that are good, but you're actually doing the kind of work that is difficult, that might be costly, that might cause you to be persecuted, that might cause you to be imprisoned, that might cause you to get exiled to an island like Patmos. You're doing that kind of labor. And then he mentions their endurance or their perseverance, which would be necessary if you're going to do labor, that kind of labor in that kind of environment. Work, labor, endurance. It's the same three characteristics that Paul congratulates the Thessalonian church on. In his thanksgiving to them in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 3, he talks about their work of faith, their labor of love, and their endurance of hope. He attaches these three, work, labor, and endurance, to faith, hope, and love. Those three basic character traits of the believer. So in these things, he says, you're doing well. And he adds to that, I know that you cannot or you won't tolerate wicked people, and that you have tested those who claim to be apostles but are not and have found them false. All of this has to do with their willingness to take on false teaching and false teachers. Ephesus had a tragic history of false teaching. When you look in the New Testament at places where the church at Ephesus is spoken about, it's almost always in the context of false teaching, of false doctrine, of false teachers. You probably run into it first in the book of Acts in chapter 20. When Paul is finishing up his missionary work, he's on his way to Jerusalem where he's going to be arrested. And on his way, he wants to stop at a little island off the coast from Ephesus. and he wants to speak to their elders, to their leadership. And he has a sermon there. And part of what he says in Acts 20, 29 through 31, he warns them that savage wolves would enter in and not spare the flock. Even from your own number, men will arise and distort the truth in order to draw away disciples after them. So be on your guard. Now that was his warning. That's Paul warning them about AD 57. Just a few years later, we have his writing of the letter to the Ephesians. Probably somewhere between 60 and 62. So just 3 to 5 years after he'd warned them. And here's what he says in Ephesians 4:14. He looks forward to the day when they would no longer be infants tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of doctrine and by the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful thinking. So he'd warned them about it. Now he sees it coming to be, and he writes them to encourage them to grow past it and to move beyond it. And then he writes again in his letter to 1 Timothy, the letter to Timothy, written probably about 65. And he's encouraging Timothy in his ministry at Ephesus. And guess what he talks about? This is chapter 1, verse 3. As I urged you when I went to Macedonia, stay there at Ephesus so that you may command certain people not to teach false doctrines any longer.